This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Dr. Teresa Einman, who's the superintendent of the Crown Point Community Schools. The school district has picked up an Innovator of the Month award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana for the work that has happened over more than a decade with the school corporation and Dr. Einman. We'll find out more. Also today, we have another of the series of conversations from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. And we'll also have a conversation with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez. He'll tell us more about some ongoing training with his department concerning active shooters and the preparations needed to deal with an active shooter situation. That and more coming up, but first the news. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana have offered up two more Innovators of the Month awards for the month, and one of them is going to our next guest here on Regionally Speaking. Dr. Teresa Einman has been the superintendent of the Crown Point Community Schools for now 13 years now. Hard to believe that she's been in the community and doing a lot of things to help improve the educational process for young people in Crown Point and vicinity, and she's with us to talk about it. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. I feel like this is lucky 13 for us. This means that all the children in my school corporation have been with me as their only superintendent, so I'm very honored to speak with you today.
Well, let's go back 13 years. What was the Crown Point Community School Corporation like when you took over as superintendent?
Well, I was recruited to consider Crown Point Schools. I was not interested in northern Indiana because I thought you had blizzards up here all the time. But I was recruited as a change agent, an innovator, someone who could move this corporation and our student achievement to higher levels. And that's what we did because we lacked, at that point, focus. And I thought it was a pearl to polish, a wonderful opportunity for a forward-thinking superintendent like myself. And that's exactly what we've done over time. We've improved. And we've always been a good corporation, so that's why I like Jim Collins' work as a foundation. He's a writer about business research of the best American companies. And I came across an airport once, his first book, which is a first book on the research, Good to Great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was a compilation of the best American companies' research on how they became that top-tier performers. And then later on, he came out with Great by Choice, which he studied the corporations who maintained that high level over time, which is where we're at now. We're maintaining. We follow the good to great research principles, business principles, and now we're with the Great by Choice principles, which is maintaining that high level of performance for our students. And we're a destination site now, you probably know, for families moving in throughout the state.
Right.
And Illinois area, our housing starts, our climbing, enrollment's climbing. And we have, interesting enough, we have closed enrollment here. We only accept families who move into our community. So they come and they be a part. That's part of the best practice research, by the way. They become part of the community and involved in our community. It's a wonderful community. We take in a portion of Cedar Lake, all of Crown Point, and all of Winfield.
And you mentioned about the fact that you basically take in new students based on the people that come into the community. And do you find that it's been easier over the last few years, at least, and maybe the entire 13, as the school corporation has made the improvements, to be able to show people that, hey, this is a great school corporation to bring your children to and to educate them and send them on to maybe college or to trade school or whatever they want to do later?
We brag about our students, and we have multiple data points now. I remember asking my principals 13 years ago what we could put on a public relations document about our successes. They were puzzled by that question at that time and were able to come up with a half a page. Now, today, it's easy for them to brag about our students because we are statistical analysis people. We are driven by data, which is what best companies do.
Mm-hmm.
So we have four-page brochure now of all of our data-driven improvements, and that's on our website as well. So it's something to brag about for our community and our family and our business community, too, because we're obviously the economic engine for this area, and we have 1,600 employees. We have healthy salaries. Mm-hmm. So this is really the economic engine of this entire area. We're very proud of that because our students go on. We now have a record-breaking 98% graduation rate, which is almost perfect, which is where we're headed. That's our goal always.
Well, in fact, you even started out, you were close, but not quite there. You had started out at 86%, I guess, when you
That's
took
right.
over the corporation. So you've seen the steady improvement over the years, and I know that it is something that takes a while. It doesn't happen overnight.
Oh, no, absolutely not. It's two steps forward, one step back. Yeah. We have specific action plans every year. We have SMART goals. Everyone is accountable to continuous improvement. We really buy into the research of logistics and analytics, principles of best business practices, and you can see the results because when you look back, you think, oh my goodness, look at what we've been able to do for our families. When it seemed like insurmountable goals that we wanted to be competitive worldwide, which we are now. We're very competitive worldwide. We actually sought out Advanced Ed Worldwide Accreditation, which has education standards for a student who would like to live in Japan as well as the United States of America.
We're talking with Dr. Teresa Eyman, who's the superintendent of the Crown Point Community Schools, which, by the way, has picked up one of the latest Innovators of the Month awards from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana. And Dr. Eyman, you were mentioning here, and you mentioned at the start of our conversation, and the information from the Society of Innovators also bears this out, too, about the Good to Great book that you came across from Jim Collins that kind of gave you an idea of when you came into the school corporation, how you can make the improvements and the like. And it notes then, too, about the fact that it was a kind of an interesting catalyst to be able to come up with ways to offer better accountability and a performance discipline as well, too. And did you find that through that book and the other accompanying books that you've been able to take advantage of from Mr. Collins, that businesses are not all that different from school corporations?
School corporations are big business, and that's part of the innovative thought patterns we have here. And that is an accepted statement from all of our leaders. They understand that we provide a service to our community, and they actually pay for that service a lot. So yes, we have a culture of discipline here and ethic of innovation. I like to say many times we get the right people on the bus and ask the wrong people to exit for our employees. So we definitely have a blend of all of us here, core values that are non-negotiable, but the strategies we deploy for continuous improvement are subject to proving merit.
I know that 7 years ago that you had the opportunity as the superintendent of the Crown Point Community Schools to come before residents, voters, patrons in the school district, ask for some financial assistance. You got it back then 7 years ago, and now you're up for renewal this time. What are you asking the voters here in the spring 2018 primary election, because that's when this referendum is going to be up before it's considered, what the voters are going to be asked to do again, once again, I guess, from what was done back in the 7 years ago?
Yes, the financial foundation of a school corporation allows us to accomplish our mission. So that is an ongoing action plan as well. And being a chief financial officer myself in my past life, I can speak the language and understand the data and love mathematics. So when the recession hit, when the state took away property taxes from our teacher fund, when the legislature to address the recession reduced funding for public schools $300 million, and that's over each year for several years now. The warning signs were clear. And actually, we have what I call a war room for kids, uh-huh. which is a strategy room. You've probably seen that in the journal, where we have data charts. And one of those is a financial data chart where what was happening. So we began to do what we do with all of our goals, is have an action plan. And at that time, it took me took us 2 years because we had 1 year of research of what it meant. What because referenda are new to Indiana. They're common in some other states, but not Indiana. So we had a huge education challenge to educate our folks on what is this about. First of all, what is a referendum, and then what's the financial piece? What happened? And so educating our folks that in Indiana, each state, first of all, has their own way of funding public schools.
Right.
It's in state constitutions, not the national. So Indiana has a history of funding its high-achieving districts the lowest. So we had no room to cut when those cuts came because we were already funded the lowest. Even our students, which is just some of the oddities in the funding formula, even our students who come from poverty, and that's one out of every four or five children, folks don't realize we have 20 to 24% poverty, they were funded less than anywhere else. If that child came from another corporation with higher poverty, they would receive a lot more money for that student. We didn't, even for the student needs of that level of poverty. So we had a huge education piece. First of all, I educated myself for a year as the leader, and then for a year with having over 400 individual meetings. It was quite a education piece. But our right. community, once they understood, they were supportive and behind us. Not something I enjoyed because I'm not one to panhandle or any of that, and I knew it was a hard, difficult concept. But our community is a wonderful community, and once they were informed, they supported us. Yeah. So what happens now is the law says that the referendum is for 7 years, and I see why. I really didn't want to go through this again, but I see why. Because you have to go back to your community, and they have a right to know, did you fulfill your promises to us?
Now, you really have to kind of sell them again, on the idea of what you did the first time 7 years ago, and convince them that it is going to be worth doing for another 7 years.
Yes, that we fulfilled our promises, and we told them what we didn't want to cut because of financial constraints of Indiana. We will put in this fund referendum, which we did, and it's audited, and it's all a public record, et cetera. But we said we don't want to cut any of our teachers, reduce teachers for financial reasons. So we have over 70 professional educators in that separate fund with all their benefits. That's obviously the number one cost, and the number one, and it should be. Number two, and we did professional surveys, too, to see what our people valued. Thank goodness they valued our teachers number one. So those teachers are there. So that's number one. Number two, they valued our extracurricular activities. You know, all the spell bowl, the Vex robotics, the choir, band, and orchestra after school programs. You know, all those extracurricular activities, which are over 400 to 500 extracurricular activities, because it's been a priority for us, because those extracurricular activities are directly correlated by research to higher GPAs, grades. As you can imagine, students being involved with significant role models pursuing interest after school hours. So we didn't want to cut those, and all the teachers get for doing that is a little stipend, like $500, $1,500, for all that time they spend. So those are so valuable, and we create those clubs for kids. So those 500 extracurricular activities are in there. 70, more than 70 teachers. And then the third thing that's real important to our people, it's just not required by law, is we have nurses in all of our schools, highly qualified nurses, and that was really important for our families. When the recession came and the state cuts came, a lot of school corporations cut the extracurricular activities. They cut any extra nurses. They didn't have anything extra they cut. They cut teachers. We said we don't want to cut those three things that's so important to you, and that's what they funded, and that's what's in there today. And that's what we're asking them to retain, keep our schools great.
If they approve the request for the renewal of the referenda, that yes. There'll be no increase in taxes.
Right. It's the same 21 cents they approved 7 years ago, and it's for another 7. So they'll have another opportunity to revisit in 7 years. Yes, 21 cents, no change.
If you will, give us an idea here on the timetable. We know that we're coming up here, I guess, for the actual question that will be on the ballot in May, on May 8th, on the primary election day. What happens after that if things go well and you do get the renewal?
Well, we'll continue. We haven't cut the 70 teachers in there. We'll stay with all their benefits. All the extracurriculars will stay, and we'll continue to increase those because they're so valuable and less expensive. And we'll maintain our nurses. So what you see today with all the results we have, with what they've given us, been so generous and kind to give us, will continue on. We will continue to construct rather than decompress.
Yeah. I noticed, too, that there have been more and more school superintendents, not only here in Northwest Indiana, but in some other places in the state, that have taken a close look at the successful referenda and saying that, well, these folks did something right. They were able to follow the procedures they wanted to proceed and encourage their patrons to support them. And in turn, we've had more successful referenda. In fact, it's even surprised some of the people that keep track of this data that it's gone so well. Do you sometimes get asked by other superintendents, not only here in the region but elsewhere, well, what did you folks do that you did right that you seem to have had so much success in?
Absolutely, because we were the first in the region and among the first statewide, but certainly in the region, the seven counties, contiguous counties. So that's why the education piece was so lengthy and time intense. So, yes, we were asked after that, how did we do it, and we've shared those practices. You know, we went to the people. You know, we went to our people. That was 400 meetings that we held with individuals and small groups and large groups. We went to the people with honesty, which is, here's where we're at, and what do we value in our community? Well, they value their schools. They value their children's education, and we shared those strategies. So in our brochures, the things that you need to do to inform people and then be a listening soundboard for them as well as to what they value in our community.
Dr. Teresa Eyman, thank you for spending time with us today to talk not only about the school corporation that has picked up the Innovator of the Month Award for the success over the last 13 years, but also the success for this referenda that's done so well for the school corporation to keep things going and improve things over the last now 7 years. We appreciate you spending some time with us to talk about it today.
Thank you. Keep our schools great.
Crown Point School Superintendent Teresa Eyman. The next stories come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up in Chicago, Illinois. I attended a small high school called Morgan Park Academy on the south side of Chicago. I actually started going to Morgan Park Academy in the seventh grade. The reason I started going there is my father went to the public school that I was attending, Fort Dearborn. When he got there, he talked with the teacher, and the teacher noted some problems that I was having, hanging with the wrong crowd, and the teacher asked my father if I was interested in having him go to another school. So they ended up putting me in private school and taking me out of public school in the seventh grade. I was what you call a latchkey kid, meaning you stay home until the parents came home at 2-3 in the afternoon, and then you could go out. But until then, you stay in the house, you don't let anyone in the house. I was always told to work on homework after school, so for 2 hours after school I would have to sit and make sure I worked on homework. But I was rather lazy and mischievous in the classroom. Just getting into a lot of trouble, a lot of referrals to the principal's office, not paying attention in class, just not really being focused on what I needed to academically. And I guess he saw something that said, hey, you know, this kid could go either way unless his parents kind of step in and do something different with them. My family wasn't an affluent family. Both of my parents were postal workers, so they worked that postal shift night and day, rain, sleet, or snow. And they put me in private school, which was a bit of a culture shock for me because I was then in a school with kids that had more affluent families, meaning they were doctors, lawyers, politicians, things of that nature. So it was a bit of a culture shock for me in the beginning because I would have to travel about an hour to get to the school, so taking the bus one way while my other friends and people that I knew and grew up with in the neighborhood were going another way was a bit of a transition. I remember my uncle used to take me to school in the seventh grade, and my uncle drove a cab. So my uncle would drop me off right in front of the school in this big old Beetle Volkswagen looking taxi cab. And the kids would ask me, why do you drive a cab to school? And I remember very vividly telling them, my parents are so rich that they had to hire a cab for me because I was embarrassed about, you know, coming to school in a cab when other kids were getting there in BMWs and Audis and, you know, other, you know, bigger cars. And I remember an embarrassing moment, and I think my uncle caught on. I never asked him if he did. But in the seventh grade, I acted like I had a basketball injury and I was limping because I was getting teased so much about coming to school in this cab. I had him stop a little further back and told him, you know, I wanted to walk this injury off. So the biggest transition I had to make was in the academics. The real first exposure I had to what you would call honors classes, and then just the reading levels that those kids, you know, those kids were reading novels in the seventh grade, and I don't think I would have read a novel until I reached high school if I had stayed in public school. I also remember very vividly attending that school, it being more of a diverse culture. That was the first time that I really experienced going to school with white kids, kids of international nature, whether it be Indian, Korean, Chinese. So I think in a lot of ways it prepared me for coming to Valparaiso University, but my experience in high school was quite different because I would still go home and it would still be my neighborhood and I could still fit in. My friends helped me stay grounded. When I first came to campus, one of the problems that I experienced was, where do you get a haircut? I made the mistake one time of letting someone in Valpo cut my hair, and that was the last time I did it. But when I first came to campus, people told me, hey, we usually get together on the weekends, we pull our money, a couple of dollars, and we go rent a rec. And when they explained to me what that was, they said, we rent the car so that we can go to Gary to get our haircut, because there's no place in Valpo that you can get your haircut for African-American students. Particularly funny story about the rent-a-rec. It was my sophomore year in college. We had all decided we were going to get together that weekend and rent a car. There were five of us that got together, $2 each, to rent the car and drive back and forth. Well, of that five, some of us had classes one time, some of us had classes another time. So three of us went in the morning, two of us went in the afternoon, and then we returned the car later that day. We got a call maybe about 3 weeks later from Chief Lloyd and from an officer who wanted us to come in and interview us. So immediately we all got kind of nervous as to, you know, why would the police department want to be interviewing us? When we came in, they sat us down in separate rooms, interviewed us at separate times. When they interviewed me, I remember vividly them asking me, why do you guys rent cars on the weekends? And I was, again, that curiosity came up. Why am I here to talk about why we rent a car and why I'm getting my hair cut? Well, it turns out they had a rash of burglaries in the community. And after doing some investigating, they figured out that a group of African-American students on campus would rent cars, go to Gary, come back, and on that particular weekend, we went twice. So they thought we were fencing stolen property and taking it back and forth to Gary, and that we did that on two occasions. I found that curious because they didn't understand the whole concept of why you have to travel all the way to Gary just to get your hair cut. And anyone who knows, cutting African-American hair and cutting a Caucasian person's hair, there's differences to it. You can't cut my hair with scissors and make it look decent. You just can't. You have to use clippers, and not everyone is skilled in using clippers. So we had to school them on the art of getting a haircut.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Indiana County jails struggle with overcrowding, so a common practice is to transfer inmates to another jail that has available space. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Charlotte Tuggle reports that that process can cost local law enforcement thousands of dollars a month, as sheriffs are effectively renting cell space from each other.
In Wabash County Sheriff Bob Land's office, there's a sign hanging above his desk that reads, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking that created them." One of his problems is shared by many other Indiana sheriffs. His county has more criminals than the county jail can house. Land says it's been that way for years, and he's been sending inmates to other jails since he took office in 2011. Land says the shuffle process is simple and can be done quickly and on a rolling basis as needed.
We determine that we need to transfer some prisoners out. We call that facility, see if they have space. and we go through the judge on court orders, and the transfer orders are signed, and they're taken to that facility.
But it comes at a price. The county is charged for every person they send out per day.
As of right now, Miami County, I'm paying $35, and it's probably going to go up to $40, I believe, maybe $42, pending an agreement that I would have with Miami County.
On the day of the interview, there were 43 Wabash County inmates in the Miami County facility. That's about $1,500 just for one day's time. Indiana code mandates the county transferring the inmate be responsible for providing transportation, plus a daily cost of housing and, quote, any additional costs reasonably necessary to maintain the health and welfare of a transferred inmate. The daily cost has usually been $35 a day, but the Indiana Sheriff's Association is currently studying whether it needs to be adjusted. At that rate, Land says he shelled out more than $500,000 just to Miami County last year.
The only benefit to us, it gets them out of our facility for our overcapacity problem. You know, Miami County is loving about everything. You know, they have a newer facility and they got space, so they're probably loving every county paying them. I know they're loving me for a little over $600,000 I paid them last year.
Even though Wabash County gets some money from the State Department of Correction, the county's out nearly $400,000. But it could be even more expensive. Henry County has incurred legal fees because it's been sued for its jail overcrowding, and in Howard County, litigation led the county to spend millions on new facilities. Miami County's jail is on the other side of the equation. The facility's only 7 years old and houses three times as many people as Wabash County's jail.
So we have some from Huntington County, Cass County, Wabash County, Fulton County, Howard County, Carroll County, Madison County.
That's Sheriff Tim Miller. He says he billed out more than $1 million total to those counties for contracted bed space last year. Miller says that money goes to the county's general fund. He sees a money-making opportunity in empty space among his jail's 240 beds.
And if we are well under that, why shouldn't I, as sheriff, receive inmates from other counties in order to generate revenue for our county?
But there is some risk for the receiving county. More work for jail staff, including tending to transferred inmates' medical considerations, and sometimes, according to Warren County Jail Commander Don Hensley, overseeing the most problematic offenders from other counties.
We have had experience that when we do take people from other jails, they normally send you the people that are troublemakers or several medical issues.
The receiving county has the right to refuse a transfer if that happens, and some sheriffs don't accept transfers at all for fear their jail will become overcrowded. Still, transfers are only a temporary fix, and many counties who are transferring inmates out don't have the money to build a new jail. Other options include setting up work release programs and putting people on house arrest. And Kiminori Nakamura, a criminal justice professor at the University of Maryland, says the problem extends beyond the local level.
At the end, if they're just shifting population from state to jail, local or local to state, you're probably not, you know, fixing that sort of fundamental problem, right? Just too many people, you know, within the correction system.
To fix that, Nakamura says all affected parties have to find a viable solution. That includes the legislature, prisons, and other corrections officials, meaning sheriffs won't be able to fix the state's overcrowding problem on their own. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle.
If you've ever tried to make a call at a busy sporting event, you know how the cell phone network can get jammed up. Now, just imagine having that problem if you're a first responder trying to make a contact during an emergency. A nationwide cellular network called FirstNet aims to solve that problem. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports that one tragic event in particular led the first responders to realize that they needed some better communication tools.
More than 1,000 relief crews
there
tried to
clear
away.
There were a variety of developments this day after the terrorist attacks in New York.
14,000 firefighters and paramedics.
Terrorist attacks on 9/11 required assistance from thousands of emergency responders. And one thing became abundantly clear. They couldn't really communicate well.
The 9/11 Commission report came out and said public safety needs expanded bandwidth and their own bandwidth. And so that was the push to get there.
David Weiss is the executive director of the state's Integrated Public Safety Commission. He says over the years, government officials have worked to improve radio systems for first responders. They launched FirstNet in 2012. The 25-year project gives local agencies priority on an AT&T cellular network. All 50 states opted into the deal. The city of Noblesville is the first in Indiana to join the FirstNet network. Fire Chief Greg Wyant says the goal is to enhance communication between emergency personnel.
It's almost like a separate cellular system. So here's the public cellular system, here's our cellular system. And we get priority. So it will drop the public before it drops us.
The more people using a cell tower in a particular area, the more congested it gets, and it can only handle so many concurrent users. As Wyant climbs his way up into a fire truck, he shows me one of the computers the responders use. He says it made sense for Noblesville to start using FirstNet for a few reasons.
We're already using AT&T products across the board of the city. There was no reason to wait. They're ready for us to sign on. Let's do it. So we did.
But the Noblesville-Hamilton County area also draws significant crowds regularly. There's Connor Prairie, a popular outdoor museum, and the Ruoff Music Center. Thousands of music lovers crowd into the venue every summer. Police Chief Kevin Jowett says that alone can cause capacity issues, even if it's not an emergency situation.
Concertgoers will frequently stream live from a concert. That takes up a lot of bandwidth with a lot of people doing that. So it really decreases the capability of other people being able to get on the network and use it.
AT&T is investing around $40 billion to add new cell towers across the country. But costs for local agencies should stay about the same if they already use a cell plan. Noblesville Mayor John Ditzler says under FirstNet, the city won't need any additional funding.
Our rates, if you will, with AT&T are what they were, but we were just fortunate enough to get this added benefit and would hope that others would follow.
Only a handful of cities around the country are currently participating in the network. Weiss says it's going to take some time for agencies to transition. He says communications equipment can be a pricey venture, and for some, it may not be the priority right now.
There's a number of agencies that don't pay for cell phones now for their public safety people. If they're not doing it now, they're probably not going to jump onto this right away until they can figure out a mechanism to pay for, you know, those opportunities.
But Noblesville leaders say the need to improve communication between agencies is the reason the network exists. So others need to get on board for the project to truly succeed. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
We're back with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. to talk about a very serious topic, unfortunately one that is in the news these days, dealing with active shooter and being prepared for these people. Sheriff Martinez, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. It's great to be on.
Well, in this day and age, I guess you never know what's going to happen in public. Is active shooter awareness becoming a part of our new normal, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. The days of just having officers at the schools as officer friends or just a school resource officer has changed. Our role has now become more at security as well as a school resource officer. We live in a day and age where having drills in schools for tornadoes or fires, but now we're having drills for active shooters, and it's just the society that we live in right now.
Now, I know that lately, of course, we've been dealing with the tragedy that's happened in Lakeland, Florida. We tend to think of active shooter preparedness, I guess, mainly for schools, but I guess there also seems to be very much more of a need now in more public places like hospitals and even churches and concert venues and maybe even, unfortunately, some workplaces, too, I understand.
Absolutely. It's the same thing with active shooters. No matter if it's a school, a workplace, any venue that has a large crowd, any event that they can maximize the injuries or death when they're trying to carry out the horrific acts. So everyone is vulnerable. But when you think about it, it's the same type of training that we have to have, either for the schools, a place of employment, and for officers when they're responding.
I understand that there are certain things that just anyone should know, keep in the back of their minds. Obviously, unfortunately, we should have to think about these things these days, but it's turned out to be that way. And it's kind of easy to kind of sum them up into three categories of action of some type.
Right.
Run, hide, and fight, I guess, is the way that you can put it this way. Will you break those down and tell us what we should know in each particular category?
Absolutely. First and foremost, when you receive or when you believe that there's an active shooter situation or there's an alarm or a code in the school and a workplace, immediately call 911. Mm-hmm. Assess the situation and evacuate. That should be your first reaction, is to evacuate. Get away from the school, the place of employment, or where the incident is taking place. Sometimes that can't happen. So if you cannot evacuate and there's no way to escape, then the next thing is to hide. And there's a difference between hiding. It's either concealment, where you're hiding, but probably a bullet can get through where you're hiding and you can still get hit, or cover, finding a solid object that you don't think a round or a bullet can get through. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, when you're hiding or concealing yourself, you want to barricade yourself. Take shelter and barricade yourself in that room, because every second counts. As the first shot is shot, 911 is placed. Then the officers are being dispatched. Then officers are responding. Buy yourself as much time as you can by barricading yourself in, because every second counts. And the longer you can barricade yourself and stay safe until police arrive, that's the best thing. And lastly, it's between life and death. You're going to have to take action if that time comes. You're going to have to fight to survive, mm-hmm. and that's the reality. And sometimes it'll take a group effort, or just by yourself, or knowing when the shots are not being fired and they're reloading, grabbing any object in the room to defend yourself as you're hiding or concealing yourself. Those are the best things you need to know.
I guess when we get to this point, after the incident has happened, there are some important things that anybody that happens to be involved in some type of active shooter situation should know. What are some of these things that are not only a matter of kind of after the aftermath, but also a way to keep those people who've been involved in this thing safe themselves?
Right. Well, we have to reevaluate on how these policies and procedures and drills are being done at the school, because as we know, some of these active shooters will pull the fire alarm and wait as the students and teachers are coming out into the hallway to evacuate the schools. So we've been proactive. We had active shooter last week that was already set before any of the shootings, and mm-hmm. Had meetings with a lot of the chief of police throughout the Lake County to come out with the county protocol. But we've been training just as officers going into the schools to neutralize a threat. What we need to start doing is training with faculty, teachers together, with school resource officers, and fire department as well, and reassess how to respond and react and to assess when the fire alarm is pulled. And when you look at it, in the last 50 years, I don't believe there's been a student that has been killed in a school fire, yet we invest a lot of money into fire alarm sprinkler systems, fire retardant walls. I think we need to start investing a lot more money into the security of our children. We do have school resource officers in our jurisdiction, but not in all the schools.
Right.
So that's another thing that we need to look at. But for now, it's on the schools that we don't have school resource officers in, is beefing up patrols, putting the responsibilities of the patrol officers to do patrol checks at those schools during their shift. Do a walk, not just outside perimeter, but do a walk around inside the schools that's within their jurisdictions until we can get enough officers there into the schools. Mm-hmm. And pretty much trained with them, with the students, with the faculty, with the teachers, and that way they understand that when police officers are arriving, we're not going to stop to help the injured or answer any questions. We're going to proceed to the area where shots were last heard and respond quickly to neutralize the threat, and including lethal force. So that way, everyone understands our response and what we expect of the teachers and the students.
We're talking with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. about the concerns and the preparedness for active shooter incidents, if they should happen to come. You talked a little bit here about the fact that officers obviously are going to still be focused in on making sure that that the incident is over with one way or the other. And obviously, I guess the nice thing is, too, because all of this is going to happen at the same time. You're going to have emergency medical teams coming in to help people out if they happen to be wounded. And that's going to be one thing, too. So officers don't have to worry, as you say, don't have to worry about that.
Right.
They can focus in on what they're supposed to be doing. And anybody who, unfortunately, has been involved in an active shooter incident will still know that the medical aid's there and they're going to be taken care of.
Absolutely. And the people need to know, as we're coming in, they need to remain calm and quiet. Avoid trying to asking questions or directions. Just follow the instructions of the law enforcement officers coming into the building, and to place, I mean, their hands in the air, their fingers spread, have their hands empty, visible at all times. Don't make any sudden moves or screaming. Just follow the commands of the officers as you're evacuating, because our primary responses to neutralize the threat. And other things, we have to get high tech. I know a lot of the schools have camera systems. We need to have a policy and a program where we can start monitoring a lot of the schools' cameras, so as officers are responding, dispatch can see where the suspect is at. We can tap into those camera systems and get a live feed of what's going on as we're responding, so the officers and dispatch know exactly where the threat is at.
You talked earlier here about the importance of getting with organizations, whether they're school groups, their school districts or officials, there are maybe with other organizations out there or with businesses and the like. Is it important for even family members to make a plan to be able to deal with active shooter situations?
Yes, absolutely. And it's something that even the parents should be talking with their children. I can tell you right now, in March, we're going to have training with the churches, a place of worship. Mm-hmm. We're going to have our active shooters experts there. We have several churches throughout the county. I believe it's March 20th and the 22nd that we're going to do training for the place of worship. It's train the trainer, the priests and the leaders and pastors of the church to also train their parishioners, their followers, and come up with a plan which will show them of safe zones, how to respond and how to react with an active shooter, because an active shooter is different. It can deal with a disgruntled employee. It can deal with mental illness. It can deal with just pure hatred. So the possibilities of an active shooter in a place of worship, we've seen already.
Right.
And we must be prepared across the board, place of employment and school as well.
And we know, too, that places even like the Lake County Government Center is very well prepared for this. They have drills, I guess, on a regular basis, and they have the procedures all set up, aside from the Sheriff's Department, to the other offices, though, that if there are any problems that happen to occur, that people in the building know what to do.
Exactly. And we have the technology that the employees here will receive a message through their phone. All our court security officers, along with our police officers, are trained in active shooter situations to neutralize the threat. And it's about being prepared. And just the way we're prepared and trained here at our government center, we must do the same with the schools. But we must train together. We must come up with the plan and policy together, because we have to address the source. It all starts there at the school. By the time we're responding, shots are being fired and potential lives are being taken. So we must start there with the school, with the teachers, with the students, and train together, because we know what we're going to do and train once we get there. But we need to minimize the injuries there when it first starts off there at the schools or place of employment.
Well, thank you very much, Sheriff, for your help in explaining things to us. And we know that it's important to be vigilant, of course, wherever we happen to be, and to be aware of ourselves and the surroundings at the time, and also to them. And these situations will come up, unfortunately, but if we know what to do, we're not going to panic, and we're going to let the authorities take care of things, and we'll all be better off, I suppose, in the long run.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez, Jr. The Democratic National Committee will announce later today that Indiana is one of 11 new states getting money through a competitive grant program. DNC Chairman Tom Perez says it'll fund grassroots efforts across the state, a response to what he saw as the party's failed hands-off approach in past elections. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dodlin sat down with Perez to talk about what Democrats hope to achieve.
You're putting this money into grassroots organizations. What are people going to see at the end of all this that they didn't see before?
Boots on the ground, engagement, talking to people. I have three children ranging in age from 15 to 21, and they communicate via their smartphone. That's what we're doing more of at the DNC. There's also the good old-fashioned shoe leather. I think we started losing elections as Democrats nationally when we stopped talking to people regularly.
Can you give me a sense of how different this is than how the committee acted in the past?
Well, we had a faith-based approach to Indiana in the past. We would simply tell you, we're going to pray that you can win. But we never put our money where our mouth was. We now believe, and I firmly believe, that when we invest in every zip code, we can win. And when we invest in places like Indiana, that we're all too frequently, quite frankly, flyover states for Democrats. When we invest instead of just flying over, that's how we win.
How did you choose? There's 11 recipients for this round. How did you choose who got the money?
Well, Indiana had a great application. They understood what they needed to do. They understood the power of grassroots organizing, and it was an honor to be able to invest, again, above and beyond what we're already investing. And we believe that Indiana is an important part of our strategy to take over the United States Senate and to take over the U.S. House in 2018. Joe Donnelly is poised to win re-election. I think he can do it. He's always been fighting for those kitchen table issues that people care most about. And I think we have opportunities in a number of congressional seats as well as other elections across this state. We can win everywhere. That's the lesson of 2017. Not only we can win everywhere, but we are, as Democrats, winning everywhere.
Realistically, you can't, of course, put all your resources into every state for every candidate. So and Indiana is largely a conservative state. Could you talk about how you balance that and how you prioritize maybe not pushing too much in a state where you ultimately might be wasting your money?
Well, I sure don't think we're wasting money in Indiana. I think we can win everywhere. And what we have done as a National Democratic Party is we increased our monthly investment in all state parties, because I do believe that we can win everywhere, and the evidence over the last year shows that we can win everywhere. And then this innovation grant program that Indiana, through which Indiana received this grant, we're trying to target those investments in areas where we have a particular opportunity in 2018. And I think we've got great opportunity here in Indiana in 2018, not only with Joe Donnelly, but elsewhere. There's some great candidates running for Congress and elsewhere here in Indiana. And I want to make sure at the end of the day that we swing the bat.
There's been a surge in candidates filing around the country and in Indiana as well. Do you think it could become a problem that there's not enough money to support all of those new candidates?
Well, I'll tell you, the surge in candidates is what has allowed us to succeed. And you know what? We're competing everywhere with really good candidates. And it starts at the top with Joe Donnelly. And when you fight for the issues that matter most to people, when you're not fighting the culture wars, but rather you're fighting for better wages and fair treatment in the workplace and health care and good education for your kids and college affordability for those who want to go to college and apprenticeships for those who want to take that pathway to the middle class, that's how we win. Those are the issues that people want to see us fighting for.
That was Democratic National Chairman, National Committee Chairman Tom Perez, talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dodlin. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. On tomorrow's program, we'll bring you a conversation with Ivy Tech Community College Gary Chancellor Louis Gonzalez. We'll have another edition of Green Fleet Radio for you with Carl Lissick, as well as another Lakeshore Focus program. And tomorrow's program takes a look at the two women who help offer making opportunities to give girls the chance to transition to women, growing up the hard way, that is. That's coming up tomorrow on Regionally Speaking.